5. Bull balls and bailouts. If you walked into the conference room in the speaker's office during my time working there, you'd find yourself looking at a curious sight. Smack dab in the middle of the fine hardwood table was a dark, leathery, shriveled object encased in a clear plastic box. I set it out there one day and periodically watched as people tried to figure out what it was. Once they determined exactly what was in the box, members of my staff kept trying to move it. So did members with queasier stomachs who came in for meetings. People would stack their papers up in front of us so they didn't have to look at it. Sometimes the staff would hide it in a closet or a cabinet somewhere. The speaker suite has all sorts of nooks and crannies for squirreling away stuff. But I would always rescue it eventually and put it right back on that conference table so that most mornings, every member of our leadership team would gather around, staring at it. Whenever people would ask, "Mr. Speaker, what the hell is that?" I'd tell them. This, I informed them, was the scrotum of an African Cape buffalo, which I'm told is the nastiest mammal on earth. No, I'm not a hunter, but I have friends who are, and one of them gave me this unique and touching gift. How I came to end up with a bull's ball sack on my conference table is an instructive story about how governing in Washington really works. The first thing anyone trying to figure out our government has to understand is that America is a pretty settled country, except when faced with a truly dramatic event, the Great Depression, World War II, 9/11. We just aren't built for sweeping, breathtaking change. Our system, because it doesn't allow for major swings in policy, has given American businesses of all kinds, everything from huge corporations to one-man home offices, some sense of stability in terms of what to expect out of Washington. They know that one election might shift policies a little bit to the left, and the next election will shift things a little bit to the right. But because they aren't dealing with giant fluctuations, they're able to adjust. And even though that can be frustrating to people who do want major change one way or the other, I think by and large the system has served our country well. It has provided us more stability than, for instance, a parliamentary system like the United Kingdom's, where there are often wild swings one way or the other depending upon which party gets the majority. Hotheads on either side of our political spectrum almost never understand that. Often our presidents don't get that either, especially if they cut their teeth outside of Washington. That's why it often falls to the guys who've been around for a while, like yours truly, to help them figure it out. I first came to know George W. Bush in the mid-90s. House Republicans were trying to build a closer relationship with party governors to try to get some things done that involved buy-in from the states, such as welfare reform. I was right in the middle of this as the liaison to the Republican Governors Association, which meant I go to periodic meetings where they talk and drink and discuss policy. And when those formal discussions were over, some of us would loosen our ties and play a little poker. My regular group of gubernatorial poker buddies included Bill Weld of Massachusetts, George Allen of Virginia, John Rowland of Connecticut. They were quite a crew. Allen had been a buddy of mine since his days in the House. Rowland ended up going to jail, twice actually. As for Weld, I don't really know if he was drunk for all of our games, but I know he had a cup of coffee he kept excusing himself to fill. And by the end of the night, he could hardly sit up straight. But the son of a bitch could play cards. He walked off with a lot of our money. So whatever was in that cup, or whatever he made us think was in that cup, must have helped. Either that, or he was just damn good. Then there was Governor George W. Bush of Texas. It wasn't long after he started joining our games that we all figured out his style of poker playing. Whenever he was in on any hand, we would all fold. W. wouldn't get in unless he had a packed hand. He never bluffed. He seemed incapable of bluffing, in fact. He'll probably disagree with me, but he was not a good poker player. So much for representing the namesake of Texas Hold'em. He is, however, a good friend. After Bush was elected to the presidency, he very quickly put together a meeting in Austin to discuss what he thought would be his chief policy initiative during his first term, education reform. He planned to summon who his team thought were the key players in Capitol Hill on the issue. That included The key Republicans and Democrats on the Senate Help Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. The Republican point man was Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire. Gregg was a stern, serious guy. If he smiled, it was a headline news event. I dubbed him Mr. Happy. His Democrat counterpart was Ted Kennedy. Bush knew that there wasn't a hope in hell of getting anything related to education passed by Congress without Kennedy, who was the patron saint of the National Teachers Union. And then there was me, the brand new chairman of the House Education and Workforce Committee. I still had a lot to learn about education policy. I admit that it had not been one of my top issues during my early years in Congress. As a conservative, I basically felt that education should be run by local communities, not some distant Washington bureaucrats, even me. But a whole bunch of people kept working on me to take over that committee, including Bush. That's probably because he knew whoever was chairman was going to have a big say in his education plans, and he didn't want a nut job. "Listen, I'm relying on you," he kept saying. "You're the one that's got to get this done." So, fine, I agreed. I worked overtime to study all the issues that were going to come before my committee. Before I agreed to come down to Austin for the first big meeting, however, I asked the Bush folks a question. "Hey, do you have George Miller coming?" Miller was the ranking Democrat on the committee. He was a tall California representative with a big mustache and a reputation as one of the biggest liberals on the Hill, and therefore not a fan of George W. Bush. "No Miller," the Bush folks told me. "We don't want him." I'm sure someone had told Governor Bush that George Miller was a big waste of time. So right there, we had a problem. The absolute worst thing I could do as the new chairman of a committee was to piss off my counterpart from the other party, who, by the way, knew a hell of a lot more about these issues than I did. Contrary to popular opinion, members of Congress who work together a lot, regardless of their political views, like to get along. "Well, I'm not sure I should be there if George isn't there," I said. "If you guys are really serious about getting this done, he's going to need to be part of this." And after some hemming and hawing, they agreed to invite Miller, and we all set off to Austin. Next thing you know, we're having lunch at the governor's mansion. Bush got up and gave some opening remarks about what he wanted to do with K-12 education. And then, in deference to the man's near-legendary status, Bush invited Ted Kennedy to stand up and say a few words. Then it was my turn. And then the governor looked at Miller, who he would soon dub Big George. "George, what would you like to say?" Bush asked. Miller rose and said, "I appreciate being here. If you're serious about this, I can tell you I'm serious about it too." Miller, like Kennedy, was part of the old school congressional tradition of actually making deals instead of running around trying to stop everything in its tracks. I respected them. As a matter of fact, I loved Ted Kennedy. He was a great man and a great legislator. Everyone in the right-wing media loved to attack him as some loudmouth liberal with scandals in his past. And believe me, he could be a fierce partisan. You did not want him against you. Later in the Bush years, when we were working together, I'd see him go out in front of the press, and he would just say these awful things about President Bush. He could be nasty. You just knew the presidential ears were burning somewhere in the White House. So next time I talked to Ted, I said, "Hey, Ted, can you just throttle it back a little bit?" He just kind of chuckled because he understood the game. Yes, he played to his base. But then when he sat down to work with you, he turned into a very different guy. There was the public Ted Kennedy, the liberal lion of the Senate. And then there was the private Ted Kennedy, an old school Paul who loved to get things done. A discussion with Kennedy was more than just going through the motions, which is more than I can say about a lot of politicians. This guy wanted a deal. He came to Congress to legislate. He'd work with you, he'd negotiate with you, and find a way to get to a consensus. Of course, he'd never give up on trying to get more, and his staff was even more aggressive. But he was a workhorse, and once you reached that consensus with him, he would defend it until the end. He was a crucial player, maybe the crucial player, in giving Republican George Bush, who was totally loathed by the left, a major legislative victory. Ted Kennedy was the godfather of the National Education Association. At one point, after we had finally come to an agreement on a bill, We got word that they were going to come out in opposition, which could have sunk everything. So I picked up the phone and I called Kennedy. "Ted," I said, "these are your people. You need to stop this. They don't have to endorse this bill, but they can't be out there in opposition to us. The bill doesn't have a chance otherwise." Of course, I didn't need to explain this to the veteran legislator. "I understand," he said. "What can I do?" I never thought it would end up being my job to order Ted Kennedy around, but this was no time to hesitate. "You go down to their meeting right now," I said, "and tell them this is good for kids. Tell them they may not love every part of it, but they can't get in the middle of this and screw it up." Well, maybe I didn't say screw. Ted got the message and simply said, "I'm on my way." Later that night, the NEA issued a decision to take no position on the bill. Well, that took care of one hurdle. Now it was my job to take care of the conservatives. Even though we had a Republican president, there were plenty of Republican members in the House who would have been okay with abolishing the U.S. Department of Education. They weren't too excited about passing a brand new federal education law. More accurately, they had no interest at all, zero. A couple of members of the GOP decided to put forward an amendment to our bill that would effectively give almost all control over education to the states. Now, as I've said, this happened to be an idea I largely agreed with over the years. A lot of conservatives did. But this amendment was not actually trying to solve a problem. It had no hope of being passed by the House and Senate. This was a classic case of people wanting to make a statement versus people wanting to get something done. I knew it would be a disaster. And then George Miller confirmed it. "You put this into the bill," he told me, "and we're done." Well, the trouble was that most people in the Bush White House didn't get it at all. They'd say, "What's the big deal with this amendment? We all want to give more education control to the states, don't we?" They didn't have a clue that this could blow up one of the president's major priorities. Sometimes it really seemed like there was nobody in charge. In May 2001, while we were in the middle of negotiations on the education plan, and this amendment was threatening to send everything crashing down, I did what I often do when I need to take a step back and clear my head. I went to play golf. I was due to head down to South Carolina for a golf weekend, but I had some free time before I left. So I went to play 9 holes at Burning Tree. One of the guys in my foursome there was Dave Hobbs, who worked in the Legislative Affairs Office for the White House. For all 9 holes, he drilled into my head about how much trouble I was in with the White House and the congressional Republican leadership. Somehow, this all had to get sorted out. There was going to be a big meeting at the White House on Monday to try to get that done. So before I left to go to beautiful South Carolina with my friend Saxby Chambliss, Tom Latham, and some other guys from D.C. and Ohio, I was warned that Dick Cheney was going to call me over the weekend. Cheney was not the biggest fan of these education initiatives, I knew, and he had the power to torpedo the whole thing if he wanted. Still, he knew this was important to the president, so I figured we weren't sunk yet. This was back in 2001, before everybody had cell phones. I certainly didn't have one. So they gave Cheney's office a number to Saxby's phone. We weren't allowed to have cell phones on the course, but we would check as soon as we came off. But the call never came. Not Saturday, not Sunday. Finally, the weekend was over. We were getting into our cars for the ride to the Savannah airport when the call came through from the vice president. I'd rehearsed this conversation with Cheney in my head all weekend. It probably distracted me out on the golf course. We talked over our plans for the education bill and how this Republican amendment would screw everything up. He made no secret of the fact that he was okay with the bill blowing up, but I knew the president didn't feel that way. The meeting was that afternoon, and as long as I got back in time, I figured I had as good a shot as anyone at keeping Bush on our side. By that time, we got into the airport. We took off and made our first scheduled stop in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. But before we could take off again, we got word that there was a line of thunderstorms headed straight for Washington. We were stuck. I knew I was going to be late. My first phone call was to David Hobbs in the Legislative Affairs Office to tell him we were delayed and asked him to push the meeting back. His response was what I expected. "Are you crazy? This was a meeting with the President of the United States, and they weren't going to reschedule it for me. And I knew that if I didn't show up, there would be plenty of people in that room who would love to talk Bush into supporting the House Republican amendment that would kill the bill. They would have just been fine if I didn't show up. I couldn't let that happen. After a few more anxious minutes of chain smoking, we still showed no signs of moving, but I had another idea. I called Hobbs back. "Can you at least get us pushed up in the lineup once they open up D.C.?" I asked. And sure enough, someone from his office got to the FAA in time to push our flight to the front of the line to land in Washington. But I was still running late. I had no time to change clothes. I borrowed a jacket from Saxby and a tie from Latham, got mostly dressed on a plane, and jumped out as soon as the door opened. I ran across the tarmac, dodged huge puddles left and right. It would have been even worse to show up late and soaked, and made it to the car that two staffers had driven over in to pick me up. I could hardly look more out of place. I've been playing golf 4 straight days, had a pretty good tan going, and was dressed in borrowed clothes that didn't fit right. When President Bush's father, George Herbert Walker Bush, was a congressman from Texas, he had once been summoned to meet President Nixon at the White House. And instead of heading the short distance down Pennsylvania Avenue, he drove all the way to his home in northwest Washington, D.C., to change his shoes from loafers to wingtips because he just didn't feel that loafers were appropriate for the White House. I couldn't afford to be that proper at that moment. I would be lucky to just get there, and somehow, by the grace of God, I was only 15 minutes late. Now, that may not seem like much, but President Bush always made a big stink about being on time for everything. Mr. Impatient would probably show up early for his own funeral, so he probably wasn't going to be too happy with me. Everyone was already gathered in the Oval Office. The congressional Republican leadership was there, so were Cheney and plenty of White House staff. The president looked up at me with a big frown on his face and immediately gave me grief for being late. I apologized, and while he didn't seem satisfied, he let it pass. As I sat down, he said, "All right, if I continue?" Ouch. Apparently, some people were glad I had made it so they could get their licks in. As soon as the president had finished his opening remarks, everyone else who spoke took their opportunity to kick me further and further under the bus. Even my buddy House Republican leader Dick Armey was grumbling about me. Boehner's causing problems with the rest of the House Republicans. Boehner's trying to kill a good amendment. Boehner's caving to the liberals and his new pal Ted Kennedy. On and on it went. I hadn't taken a beating like that since I played football. But the man whose opinion mattered most, the president, just sat there quietly, listening to everyone. Once everyone had their say, he looked at me and said in his crisp, to-the-point manner, "Okay, Boehner, what do you got to say for yourself?" My first thought was, "Well, you're the one who got me into this mess in the first place," but I couldn't say that out loud. Instead, with the whole room arrayed against me, I went through step by step what our bill was trying to do and why this amendment would blow the whole thing up. I was addressing the whole group, but really I was playing to an audience of one. Education reform was one of President Bush's top priorities, and he had to know the best way to get an actual bill passed was to let me handle it my way, despite all the whining from the sidelines. "Listen," I finally summed up, "you want to get a bill out of the House? We'll get a bill out of the House, even with this amendment, since we have the majority. But if this amendment goes in, we'll never get a bill passed in the Senate to put on your desk." "This is a mistake," I said. "It will kill the whole deal. We shouldn't do it." I could feel the daggers from all around the room. I tried to avoid the angriest glares. Cheney, in particular, looked displeased. But Bush was in a decider mood. Time to make up his mind and move on. "I'm with Boehner," he said, simply. And the meeting was over. President Bush could easily have made another decision, of course. It would have been easy. He would have won praise from talk radio hosts and those stuck-up brats who write columns on every issue under the sun who never worked a real job in their lives. He would have smoothed things over with his party in Congress, and then when the bill inevitably failed, he could score another political victory by blaming Democrats for killing it. But Bush did not do that. And I was proud of him. Not just because he sided with me, but because he trusted me with this initiative that was near and dear to him, and had the potential to help out a whole lot of kids around the country. Although as the meeting was breaking up, he couldn't resist giving me one more jab for being late. Most of the participants bolted for the Oval Office doors in a fury, probably rushing to get firewood to burn me at the stake. I had to rush after my colleagues and find some way to calm them down. We all had to work together, after all. Within a week, the House of Representatives passed our bill by a huge bipartisan margin. Plenty of people are still stewing about it. Even years later, when I passed some members in the hallway, I could have sworn I heard muttered quietly, "You let Ted Kennedy play Bush." Bush didn't get played by anybody. He accomplished a goal he'd set out to do when he was first elected, and he got it done early in his term. Oh, and by the way, the American kids get a better shot because of it. After No Child Left Behind passed Congress, Bush was so elated, not something we often saw, that he decided to keep the celebration going by holding several different signing ceremonies for the bill. He chose the locations in honor of some of the people who helped bring the new law into being. So we went up to New Hampshire for a ceremony for Jug, Mr. Happy Greg, one in Massachusetts for Ted, and one in Ohio for me, which was nice. But then, of course, there was another big event in D.C. where the president's brother Jeb came up from Florida. But to me, the most important guests were the 200 or so kids that my program had helped get scholarships to local Catholic schools. I figure these kids may never have an opportunity to meet a president again. So I wanted to make sure each and every one of them got to shake hands with Bush. So we stuck around after the event, and sure enough, Bush shook every one of those little hands. It was a beautiful moment. After that, everyone pretty much left, so President Bush and I walked out together. Before he got to the limousine to head back to the White House, I said to him, "Mr. President, I got to remind you of something." "What's that?" he asked. "Do you remember that meeting we had in the Oval Office when you stood up for my plan in front of everybody?" "Oh, yeah, I remember." "Well, I've got to tell you something. If you had made that decision that day, we would not be here today." He didn't say anything. I could tell he was thinking back to that moment. And then I started to see tears come to his eyes. And me, I'm always an easy target when that happens. Tears form my eyes, too. In front of all of his staff and Secret Service and all the spectators who showed up for the event, the president gave me a big bear hug. Then he got into his limo and left. The moment was so moving that I didn't realize for a few minutes that I was now completely alone. The event was over. I didn't have any staff with me. I hadn't driven myself. I was just standing there in the parking lot, and I had to get back to the Capitol to go to work. So I ended up having to weave through the crowd to the street and hail a cab. All the time I see people on TV or read newspaper pundits bemoaning how two parties can't get anything done together in Washington. Yes, it can be hard. But George W. Bush did it, and he did it with Ted Kennedy, one of the most liberal legislators ever to set foot in the Capitol. Of course, Bush wasn't always like that, and the Democrats weren't always so cooperative, especially as the Iraq War dragged on and Bush's approval ratings went somewhere south of colonoscopies. But for a while there, he got things done. He really worked hard at it. And when he left office, I had similar hopes for his successor, even though he came from the opposite party. But it turned out that was a whole other kettle of fish. Barack Obama promised to be different. Of course, they all promised that, but a lot of people believed Obama meant it. His campaign was about hope. It was about working together, about having new conversations. It was a pretty compelling message that most Americans rallied behind. I even knew Republicans who voted for Obama. His election as the first black president was historic, and he came in with enormous goodwill. And I thought to myself, if he actually governs like he said he would, this is going to change Washington. Early on, I tried to share with President Obama, who hadn't spent that much time in the Senate after all, how things worked on the legislative end of Pennsylvania Avenue. I told them, if you want to enact something that lasts, it has to have bipartisan fingerprints. Everyone needs a piece of it, a stake in it. The last Democrat to hold his office, Bill Clinton, understood this and worked with Republicans to pass initiatives like welfare reform in the 1990s. Obama had urgent priorities for sure. The economy was still suffering from the Great Recession of 2008, and he had to do something about that. So he pledged to pass a stimulus bill to reinvigorate the economy. But the president wasn't particularly involved in crafting the bill, leaving it instead to the Democrats in Congress, where no taxpayer dollars have ever been spared. The idea was to spend $1 trillion and boost the economy by just throwing money at stuff. But one of the things they threw almost no money at was something that should have been hugely popular: infrastructure, meaning repairs to roads, bridges, airports, etc. These projects were sprinkled through every congressional district in America. Republicans, just like Democrats, love to bring home federal dollars to fix a local highway or whatever needs fixing. There was a key opportunity here for Democrats to get Republican buy-in with more infrastructure spending in the stimulus. If they had just thrown $10 or $20 billion of that stimulus money into infrastructure, they'd have bought off at least 50 Republicans to join them. Obama would have started off with a big bipartisan bill and a big victory against the GOP, who were trying to keep everyone in line against the Democrats. But with the Democrats holding the majority in both the House and Senate, the White House didn't think they had to do any outreach to Republican members. And for some strange reason, at the same time, the new president was claiming he wanted to work closely with us. At one point during these deliberations, he said to me and some other Republican leaders, "Listen, you guys have some good ideas. Give them to me." So we outlined some ideas, and a few days later, I presented them to the president. Obama looked at the list and bristled. I never got the sense that he was a particularly warm guy, but today he was cooler than ever. "Don't like this," he said as he went down the list, "or this. We're not doing that," and so forth. "Mr. President," I said, "you said you were going to try to work with us." I assumed he knew that he wasn't going to like everything Republicans proposed any more than we liked anything he proposed. George Bush would have figured that out. He was smart about that sort of thing. But Obama just looked at me, and in his too-cool-for-school way, he said, "Well, John, you have to remember, I won." I never been sucker-punched like that in my life. It was like he kicked me in the stomach. The arrogance of that comment, combined with my own personal embarrassment after thinking he meant what he had said, was huge. I certainly didn't need to be reminded that he won the election. I just lived through 3 months of being reminded of his great victory. I read about it every day. He was sitting in the White House. I sure wasn't. But even worse than my personal discomfort over Obama's attitude was my bewilderment. It was as if they had no idea what they were on the verge of accomplishing. Republicans, and by that I mean the reasonable majority of the GOP, not the screwballs, saw the power of Obama's vision. They saw how the country responded. They knew it was in their interest to work with him, at least in the early days, because he was popular. If the administration had worked with all of us on the stimulus bill, there's a bunch of Republicans who would have voted yes. They would have hardly had to do anything except throw a few bones out there. They would have reshaped the politics of America. But he didn't do it. His rhetoric didn't help, and the Democrats on the Hill had no interest in getting Republican buy-in. That would have meant the left wouldn't have gotten everything they wanted. They would have had to have been urged by the president to do it, and he wasn't interested. The people around Obama were pushing him to talk to the far left instead of talking to America. So they squandered what I thought was a pretty big opportunity for them. Hubris will kill you in politics. After getting shut out on the stimulus, it was easy for Republicans to turn on Obama. The stimulus got labeled a big money throwaway that hurt him with voters, since it didn't have bipartisan support. And then there was the Affordable Care Act, his next big initiative that came to be called Obamacare. Then, too, the White House took a back seat and let Democrats in Congress call the shots in putting the bill together, and of course, they shut Republicans out again. The law that finally passed ended up being something that was popular on the far left, but less popular with most of America. Today, there's not much left of Obamacare. When I was Speaker, we passed a dozen bipartisan measures to change various parts of it. It's been falling apart ever since. By the time Obama's first midterm elections came around in 2010, the shine had worn off. The electorate hadn't embraced a one-sided rewriting of our health code or generally arrogant attitude of the Obama White House. And another unintended consequence of Obamacare, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi strong-armed moderate Democrats into voting for a bill that was extremely unpopular back in their districts. In 2010, lots of these folks were thrown out and replaced by Republicans. Voters from all over the place gave President Obama what he himself called a shellacking. And oh boy, was it ever. Across the country, Republicans picked up 700 state legislative seats. You can be a total moron and get elected by just having an R next to your name. And that year, by the way, we did pick up a fair number in that category. We won 6 seats in the Senate, picked up 6 governorships in the Rust Belt, including Ohio, retook control of the House of Representatives. That put me in line to be the next Speaker of the House over the largest freshman Republican class in history, 87 newly elected members of the GOP. Now I was able to deal with Obama from a much stronger position, with a majority in Congress behind me. I decided I was going to try to get him to work with us after all. This would lead to the defining moment of my speakership. And it was also one of the most defining moments of all my years in Washington, D.C. Since I was presiding over a large group of people who'd never sat in Congress, I felt I owed them a little tutorial on governing. I had to explain how to actually get things done. A lot of that went straight through the ears of most of them, especially the ones who didn't have brains that got in the way. Incrementalism? Compromise? That wasn't their thing. A lot of them wanted to blow up Washington. That's why they thought they were elected. Some of them, well, you could tell they weren't paying attention because they were just thinking of how to fundraise off of the outrage or how they could get on Hannity that night. Ronald Reagan used to say something to that effect, that if I got 80 to 90% of what I want, that's a win. These guys wanted 100% every time. In fact, I don't think that would satisfy them because they didn't really want legislative victories. They wanted wedge issues and conspiracies and crusades. To them, my talk of trying to get anything done made me a sellout, a dupe of the Democrats, a traitor. Some of them had me in their sights from day one. They saw me as much of an enemy as the guy in the White House. Me, a guy who would come to the top of the leadership by exposing corruption and pushing conservative ideas. Now, I was a liberal collaborator, so that took some getting used to. What I also had not anticipated was the extent to which this new crowd hated, and I mean hated, Barack Obama. By 2011, the right-wing propaganda nuts had managed to turn Obama into a toxic brand for conservatives. When I was first elected to Congress, we didn't have any propaganda organization for conservatives, except maybe a magazine or two like National Review. The only people who used the internet were some geeks in Palo Alto. There was no Drudge Report, no Breitbart, no kooks on YouTube spreading dangerous nonsense that they did every day about Obama. He's a secret Muslim. He hates America. He's a communist. And, of course, the truly nutty business about his birth certificate. People really had been brainwashed into believing Barack Obama was some Manchurian candidate planning to betray America. Mark Levin was the first to go on the radio and spout off this crazy nonsense. It got him ratings. So eventually, he dragged Hannity and Rush to Looneyville along with him. My longtime friend Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News, was not immune to this. He got swept up into the conspiracies and the paranoia and became an almost unrecognizable figure. I once met with him in New York during the Obama years to plead with him to put a leash on some of the crazies he was putting on the air. It was making my job trying to accomplish anything conservative that much harder. Roger went on and on about Benghazi, which he thought was part of a grand conspiracy that led back to Hillary Clinton. Then he outlined elaborate plots by which George Soros and the Clintons and Obama and whoever else came to mind were trying to destroy him. They're monitoring me, he assured me about the Obama White House. He told me he had a safe room built so he couldn't be spied on. His mansion was being protected by combat-ready security personnel, he said. There was a lot of conspiratorial talk, and it was clear that he believed all this crazy stuff. I walked out of that meeting in a daze. I just didn't believe that the entire federal government was so terrified of Roger Ailes that they'd break about a dozen laws to bring him down. I thought I could get him to control the crazies, Instead, I found myself talking to the president of the club. One of us was crazy. Maybe it was me. Another person in that world was a golfing buddy of mine named Donald Trump. Trump has had a long habit of talking about this conspiracy or that conspiracy, and he really seems to believe in some. He spent money trying to send people to Hawaii to investigate Obama's citizenship. That's how I knew he believed there was something to it, because there was no way Donald Trump ever spent a dime on anything unless he was serious about it. He's not the kind of guy to throw around money unnecessarily. In January 2011, as the new Republican House majority was settling in and I was getting adjusted to the speakership, I was asked about the birth certificate business by Brian Williams of NBC News. My answer was simple. The state of Hawaii has said that a President Obama was born there. That's good enough for me. It was a simple statement of fact, but you would have thought I called Ronald Reagan a communist. I got all kinds of shit for it. Emails, letters, phone calls. It went on for a couple of weeks. I knew we would hear from some of the crazies, but I was surprised at just how many there really were. All this crap swirling around was going to make it tough for me to cut any deals with Obama as the new House Speaker. Of course, it has to be said that Obama didn't help himself much either. He could come off as lecturing and haughty. He still wasn't making Republican outreach a priority. But on the other hand, how do you find common cause with people who think you're a secret Kenyan Muslim traitor to America? Still, my job as Speaker wasn't to just sit around in an elegant chair all day, smoking cigarettes and planning my Fox News contract. I had an obligation to try to get something going on issues that I cared about. And so I tried with Obama yet another time. Ever since I've been in Congress, and long before, a major conservative priority has been reducing both government spending and the national debt. We shouldn't be spending more taxpayer dollars than what we brought in. There's a pretty clear consensus amongst the Republican Party. Of course, like any Republican consensus, this one was turned on its head by the far-right knuckleheads that came to Congress, radicalized by blind Obama hatred. Most of these types wouldn't really support a balanced budget amendment if I put one up for a vote, because that would be backing leadership, the number two enemy after Obama. Those chicken shits would have run 100 miles an hour in the opposite direction. They didn't really want to cut spending. They didn't want Washington to work. They wanted chaos. And they wanted to go on TV complaining about spending without actually solving the problem, and then watch the money from outraged viewers flow into their own fundraising coffers. Meanwhile, the country would still be stuck under crippling debt. It was tragic more recently to watch the Republican Trump administration abandon the debt crisis altogether, with many Republicans in Congress following their lead. By May of 2020, the Trump administration had added more than $5 trillion to the national debt. Not all of it was his fault. Some of it was due to the stimulus package needed to fight COVID-19. But Trump had been running up the debt well before the pandemic hit. The point is, we'll be buried under red ink as far as the eye can see. This makes it even harder to remember that we had a real shot at fixing this back in 2011. I was serious about rescuing our kids and grandkids from being crushed under the weight of the national debt. I still am. And I thought with a new Republican majority in the House, I might just be able to make a deal with a president who claimed to be interested in bipartisan cooperation. Barack Obama ran for president by promising to be everything George W. Bush wasn't. But golf was one thing they had in common. When he took office in 2009, I was the House Minority Leader. And as soon as President Obama arrived, there was chatter around town about inviting me to a get-to-know-you round. Eventually, the chatter made it into the press. But 2009 came and went without an invite from the White House to play golf. I guess playing nice with the Republicans took a backseat to passing the Affordable Care Act legislation on a party-line vote. And 2010 went by without an invite, too. But when Republicans took back the House that fall, and they knew I was going to become Speaker, the talk started up again in a big way. The President and I spent the first few months of my speakership publicly going after each other, but finally in late May of 2011, my office got the call from the White House. The President wanted to schedule a round for Father's Day weekend. That was fine with me. After the official scheduling work between our offices, I got a follow-up call from President Obama himself. "I've invited Biden," he told me. "Bring somebody." Shit. He wanted a full foursome. That meant he was taking this seriously. The political and optical stakes of this game were high enough, but I knew Obama and Biden were both good golfers, and I didn't want to lose, but who was I going to bring? As I mulled this over, I headed back to Ohio for a fundraiser, an annual event put on by a major Columbus utility company. The night before the event itself, the news leaked out that Obama had invited me to play golf. They even included the detail that Obama was bringing Biden, but my partner had not yet been named. When I arrived for the fundraiser, who did I see right away but my old friend, Jack Nicklaus, Ohio's own golden bear and one of the best professional golfers ever. It seemed like fate, but I also noticed he had a stricken look on his face as soon as he saw me. Naturally, everyone else at the event started teasing us about playing golf together against the president and the vice president. Jack said nothing and faced it all with a frozen smile. Finally, when we had a quiet moment, he said, "Boehner, I need to talk to you," and took me outside, found a secluded corner. "Listen, man," he said urgently, "I'd go anywhere in the world to play golf with you. You want me to help raise some money? That's fine, just say the word. But please, do not ask me to play golf with you against the president." I admit the thought had crossed my mind, but Jack was crystal clear. So I just said, "Yes, sir," and that's all there was to it. He wanted to stay away from the political spotlight, which I could understand. But being in Ohio gave me another idea. How about I invite John Kasich? Kasich and I had been friends for a long time, and he was then serving as Ohio's governor. When I say we'd been friends for a long time, I mean long time. And you know how you have some friends that are always easy and fun to be around? Then you got other friends, the kind who require some effort on your behalf, because they can get wound up a little tight. Well, John Kasich requires more effort than all of my other friends put together. But I still love the guy. I called Kasich, and he was excited to be part of it. The news I was bringing a moderate Republican governor of a swing state went over well, too. We made plans for him to fly to D.C. the evening before the match, and we would meet for dinner at the home of some mutual friends, Bruce and Joyce Gates, in Northern Virginia. Kasich showed up with an Ohio State policeman who travels with him everywhere, and I could already tell this was going to take some effort. John Kasich would have a hard time relaxing on a beach with a cocktail and a massage. But this time, I knew he was wound really tight. He didn't want to make a fool of himself before the president, the vice president, and the global press corps. "John," I told him over dinner, "calm down, for God's sakes. They're going to be a hell of a lot more nervous than we are. I'd seem to be getting somewhere with that." "We can play golf. They can play golf," I assured him. "It's just a game." By the time we left, he seemed to have calmed down somewhat. Apparently, it didn't last long. By the time my SUV picked him up at his hotel the next morning, he was a basket case yet again. He was jittery the whole ride over. "Listen," I said, "I told you. They're going to be a lot more nervous than we are. I'll guarantee you that Biden's been out there for an hour hitting balls. I guarantee it." Biden, I knew, did not want to be the anchor on the president's golf game. Sure enough, we pulled up at the course, and the first thing we noticed was that Biden's shirt was wet. So were his socks. He'd been out there pounding away in the heat for at least an hour. Yet again, I could see the relief come over Kasich's face. When President Obama arrived, they brought the carts over. We got ready to putt a few before teeing off. I got ready to go with Kasich, but before we got in, the president said, "All right, Boehner, you and I are going to take these two guys on." I looked over at Kasich. This whole time we had assumed it would be the two of us playing against Obama and Biden. Kasich did not adapt quickly to a change of plans. I thought he was going to start crying right there on the spot. Somehow he kept it together. So I rode with the president to go putt a few, and while we were in the cart, I leaned over to him and said, "Mr. President, let's just keep this about golf today, all right?" President Obama agreed. Well, that wasn't quite how things turned out. We teed off in front of the press. A huge gathering of them had come out to see us, and off we went. Since it was Father's Day, it was the Saturday of the U.S. Open, being held on the other side of D.C. at the Congressional Country Club. They broke into coverage of the pros at the U.S. Open to air footage of four amateurs, the president, the vice president, the governor of Ohio, and the speaker of the House sweating it out on the golf course at Joint Base Andrews. It was a good day out. The president had the highest handicap of all of us at 18. Kasich and I both played at 9. Biden, well, Biden told us he was a 7, but I wasn't so sure. President Obama and I won, beating them handily on the last two holes to get the match. We bet a grand total of $2, and I have a picture of Biden handing me the two bills. There was no way I was going to give Kasich the embarrassment of handing them over. Obama may have had the highest handicap, but I think he worked harder than any of us out there. His approach to golf was very focused. He stared down every shot with intense gaze. I figured it was the same intense focus he was able to propel somebody through the academic rigor of Columbia and Harvard Law, then shoot up the rungs of the Democrat ladder and win a presidential campaign after just a few years in the Senate. As I saw how carefully and critically he approached the strategic side of the game, not to mention how relatively well we got along playing together, an idea started to take hold. By the time we got back to the clubhouse, I knew how I was going to end this day. We shook hands with the current and retired service members at the base clubhouse, and then the four of us had some time to ourselves before everyone went home. I turned to the president. The day wasn't just about golf anymore. The debt ceiling was due to expire in a month and a half at the end of July. I had made clear to him before that I was not going to raise the debt ceiling without doing something about the out-of-control spending and debt problems that our country was facing. I had been working with him in the weeks before, trying to convince him that big things could be done. Big things had been done in our nation's history when there was bipartisan will behind them. After President Obama and I worked together to beat Biden and Kasich, I thought maybe we could work together to get the country's finances in order. "I think you and I can get something done," I said to him, "but it's going to have to be you and I, or we'll never make it work." The president responded positively and wanted to set up a meeting. Staff work would be necessary, of course, but we had to have absolute trust and absolute good faith between the two of us if anything was going to move forward. When we left Andrews that day, I firmly believed I had that. But soon the problem started. Right as our conversations kicked off, they ended up getting leaked to the press. And it came from my side. The House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor, had some staffers who were upset that they weren't involved in the discussions. So out came the leaks. Drip, drip, drip. I talked with Eric about this personally. He had two major concerns. He thought I was putting myself out on a limb, and he was upset that he wasn't in the loop himself. I could understand both of these. For one thing, I was putting myself out on a limb. I knew that. But I thought this effort was worth it. And for that reason, I wanted to deal with President Obama myself, man to man. So there was no loop for Eric or anyone else to be in. You can't really have a loop when it's just two people involved. There are only two points. Naturally, I had to meet with Obama in secret. We drive up the South Drive, and I get dropped off the diplomatic receiving door. If I'd have been filmed coming out of the main entrance of the White House, the right-wing news media would have decided I was selling out yet again. Or maybe they'd start questioning my place of birth. Plus, Obama had his own problems with the left-wing crowd, who thought he wasn't radical enough for them. I kept thinking, how on earth did we get to this point in our country? We kept the teams for the discussion pretty small. With me in the meetings were Barry Jackson, my chief of staff, my top policy advisor, Brett Loper. On the Obama side, it was usually his chief of staff, Bill Daley, and White House Legislative Affairs Director, Rob Neighbors, along with the administration's top economic guys, like Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and OMB Director Jack Lew. My goal was to get government spending down and get a long-term fix for the entitlement programs that were running out of money. As the baby boomers, like me, got ready to retire, the Medicare and Social Security funds would dry up even faster. I didn't want to kick the can down the road yet again and drop this problem in the next generation's lap. Of course, to get there, we would have to make sacrifices. In any good deal, everybody has to give up something they want. For us on the conservative side, that meant revenue, taxes. The Obama administration wanted more revenue coming in, and it was up to us to find ways to get there that didn't put the hurt on the average American taxpayers. All of us in those meetings understood the bigger issues, so we didn't waste time lecturing each other on the power of the free market versus the power of government. We all knew where each other was coming from, so we spent most of our time haggling over what was actually possible in order to reach a real compromise. For instance, the White House wanted the debt limit raised immediately by $1.6 trillion, but we got them down to $1.2. They wanted a minimum of $800 billion in new revenue, but we got them to make that the maximum. They agreed to spending cuts, but wanted to earmark some of the money saved for unemployment benefits. Hardly a conservative priority, but in the spirit of compromise, I went along with it. So we went back and forth for about 5 weeks. There were lighter moments, too. It was a warm summer Sunday night, July 3rd, 2011. We were outside the West Wing taking a break. Obama was drinking iced tea and chomping on Nicorette gum. No matter how stressful things got, he never once asked to bum a cigarette. My theory was he was afraid of what his wife would say, but she couldn't stop him from giving my pack of Camels longing looks. The last meeting at the White House was Sunday, July 17th. I brought Eric with me at the time, and he brought some of his top staffers. I knew it was important. As we reached the end stages of the agreement, the Cantor be brought in to field some ownership of the deal. We would need him to sell the proposal to our members. A deal was very, very close, and I didn't want to take any chances. All in all, the framework for the deal we came up with was highly favorable for Republicans and for the American people. In order to raise the debt ceiling, a Democrat administration had to give up $1.2 trillion in government spending. They would get a smaller amount, $800 billion, in revenue. But there were key components of tax reform worked into the deal that would give taxpayers a break in the long run. We would simplify the tax code to just three tax brackets with a top rate of no more than 35% and a reduction in the corporate tax rate, too. After Cantor, our staffers, and I spent the morning going over the details with the White House aides, President Obama himself came back from church and asked to speak to Cantor and me alone. We talked about how tough this would be to sell to our respective parties and that we would need each other's help in getting the votes to get it done. Obama understood the challenges, but he was confident. He reassured me personally, taking me by the arm and saying, "I have great confidence in my ability to sway the American people." Well, that was enough for me. Good faith was good faith, and at the end of that meeting, we shook hands, and I thought the deal was done. Then came a giant wrench flying into the gears from the other side of the Capitol. 2 days after our final White House meeting, a group of senators calling themselves the Gang of Six, which included my buddy Saxby Chambliss from Georgia, released their own debt reduction plan with a big to-do. And the Republicans in that group had given up more money in revenue increases, over $1 trillion, than the $800 billion I had dragged Obama into agreeing to. The president was positive about this new development. "The framework is broadly consistent with what we've been working on here in the White House," he told the media, "and with the presentations I've made to the leadership when they've come over here." Well, it was a little different than the discussions he'd had with me. I still expected him to stick to our agreement. After all, we'd shaken on it. But with the senators now putting more revenue on the table, the opportunity for new leverage was apparently too good to pass up. A couple days after the Gang of Six bombshell, President Obama called me up to alter the deal. He wanted $400 billion more in revenue. "Mr. President," I told him, "we've been having this conversation for a month now, and you know there isn't a dime more on the table." But he was insistent. "I've got to have $400 billion more," he repeated several times. "Mr. President, that's just not going to happen," I said. We went back and forth on this for a few minutes, and President Obama kept asking me to think about it. Finally, I said that I would, and we hung up. But there wasn't much to think about. It would have been hard enough to get Republican votes for a limited revenue increase in the deal as it was. I knew we were going to have to get Democrat votes to help it pass. And I expected the White House legislative operation to deliver those, helped along by the president's personal promise to sway the American people. But adding more revenue on top of that would have made it impossible to get enough Republicans on board. So the deal was basically dead. That handshake on Sunday seemed 100 years ago. to this day, I still don't understand why Obama chose to make a last-minute alteration to the deal I thought was done. I knew he was under pressure from his base, and I sure as hell was under pressure from mine. But I had made my peace with the possibility that this deal could be the end of my speakership. I knew it would piss off enough short-sighted Republicans that they just might be able to get together and boot me from office if it passed. And if our deal had passed, fixing these constant problems before our kids and grandkids had to deal with them, I wouldn't have minded losing my job over it. Not one bit. I remember telling one journalist that the House Republicans could have thrown me out of office the day after this deal passed, and I'd still be the happiest man in the world. We had everything agreed, and we could have gotten the package through Congress with plenty of Democrat votes, sure, and on to President Obama's desk. In the end, it didn't work out that way. I couldn't dwell on it, though. There were plenty of other fights ahead. But there was one, shall we say, distinctive consolation prize that came out of the whole thing. When you shoot a Cape buffalo in parts of Africa, the locals who butcher it will also eat the testicles, which they consider a prime delicacy. Then they present the leftover scrotum to whoever brought the bull down. This is what happened to my friend Jim, who kept the leathery sack encased on his desk. Until, that is, he sent it to me as a gift after I went toe-to-toe with the president. Apparently, he thought to himself, Boehner's got bigger balls than I do. I wasn't going to argue.